My name's Blessing. I'm still an alcoholic and addict. And I have the honor and privilege of introducing our speaker tonight. We are actually related, not by blood, but by more importantly, that my sponsor's sponsor is her sponsor, which makes us sisters. So yeah, so it's pretty cool like that. I met Leah probably 8 or 9 years ago out in Acworth at a meeting. I was not sober yet, I was just pretending to be. But I remember her telling her story, so I know I was sober at this point about 4 years ago. And I remember, I think I was doing my 90 and 90 at that point, and it was the first speaker I'd listened to in a while, and I think it was the first speaker that I was absolutely able to laugh with. I remember her story being poignant and funny and touching, and I could not wait to hear it again. And I've tried to get her here before. I am so, so grateful she's here now. With no further ado, here's my dear friend Leah.
Oh man, now expectations have been set. Hey everybody, my name's Leah, and I'm an addict and an alcoholic. Hey. And please let me know, I have never used a microphone correctly my entire life, so let me know if you can't hear me or if I'm blasting your eardrums. I think we're at a good, okay. I have to go ahead and preset. I'm a little apologize. I'm a little frazzled. I just got off a 3-day night shift, crazy week, and I haven't been nervous. Blessing asked me to do this a couple weeks ago, and I wasn't nervous at all. I'm excited. That's such an honor. And then this morning, driving home from work, it's like my body realized what was happening tonight, and also my heart was like, boom, 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 boom. So I tried to go home to sleep, and that didn't happen so much. But it's such an honor to be here, and especially at Ridgeview. You know, I was here in 2003 and was up in that little halfway house on the hill, too. So it's such an honor to be here today to tell my story. And, you know, I'm always humbled and amazed whenever anybody asks me to tell my story, because when you think about it, that means somebody likes you enough, thinks you're cool enough, that they want to listen to you talk about yourself for almost an hour. I mean, that's pretty cool. So that makes me feel pretty good. But I'm going to do my best tonight to tell you, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My sobriety date is September 6, 2006. And again, I was here in 2003. I started my journey here, but kind of, you know, starting from the beginning, you know, all the way as a little Leah. I always, ever since I could remember, just struggled with fitting into this world. You know, even as a kid, I was just very morose. I just didn't feel like I fit here, you know? And, you know, I always remember one of the first parts of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that struck me was in Bill's story when he was talking about how he always felt like he was on the outside looking in. And I always felt like that. And I so many of us feel that way. And I felt that way as a kid. You know, I struggled fitting in. I was dubbed the weird kid. I was just incredibly socially awkward. I was incredibly afraid, you know. We'd have company over to the house. I would crawl under the bed and hide. I'd grab my He-Man, my G.I. Joes, and we'd hide. You know, my mother would have to drag me out by my feet to get me out to meet the company. And I just, you know, so I was the weird kid, didn't have a lot of friends, got picked on a lot. You know, as I got a little older, I also noticed that there was another little thing that maybe set me apart from my peers, you know, and a lot of the kids, as we got older, we started, you know, the little girls in the class started taking a notice in the little boys in the class and all this other stuff, and I wasn't following that trend. I was like, I had a boyfriend in fifth grade, but he had a Game Boy, and that's the only reason I was interested in him, and that's what our relationship was based on, was his Game Boy. And so I knew kind of, you know, I wasn't sure, you know, what sexuality was or any of that, but I knew, even as a child, that I was not like the others. I was a little different. So that was something that kind of added to, you know, my depression. Even as a kid, looking back, I was always, you know, thought like, and then I was talking to somebody, they're like, oh, you were depressed, you know, and I was like, children don't get depressed. I'm like, yes, they freaking do. So, you know, it's just something that, you know, how much mental health has evolved with the times. It's a good thing that we can see these things early on. But as I got older, you know, I stuffed that down, you know. And it's just something I was talking to my wife earlier. I was like, you know, it's just crazy how much time has changed. It hasn't been that long. I'm 38 years old, you know. This was 90s, 80s, you know. But just where we are now is amazing compared to then. But then, you know, to be a kid or a teenager and to be out, negative. So that was something. And I talk about this a lot because this, my sexuality, being gay and being closeted and dealing with that, caused me a lot of depression, led me into like suicide attempts, and it also fueled my drug and alcohol abuse. You know, that was a major, major catalyst for a lot of the stuff that happened. But as I got, you know, older, I just learned how to stuff that down and just pretend to be like everyone else. And, you know, and I remember as a teenager, especially, you know, praying, you know, I wasn't, my parents, you know, I'm blessed with two amazing parents, you know, you know, we were never brought up religiously, but I remember, you know, I had a concept of God, and I remember praying as a teenager to God to just make me normal. And I prayed so hard, and I would cry and pray, and just make me like my friends. I want to be like everybody else. I don't want to be different. I don't want to be different anymore, you know? And I didn't start drinking. It happened a little late. My first drink was when I was 16 years old. And it happened, my parents went out of town, and so I had to have people over. I mean, that's what you did. You have people over and you do stuff you're not supposed to do. So somebody, you know, as a completely inexperienced first time drinker, I did it the best absolute way. We got Golden Grain and Gatorade. So, because that's, you know, sick as a dog. And I remember it wasn't love at first sip for me. You know, I can't say that. You know, that was the first time I drank. I didn't really care for it. I remember it made me just feel dizzy and weird. And I was sick for days and days afterwards. I almost lost my job. I worked at Sam Goody at the mall back when we sold cassette tapes. And I almost lost my job. And so that really upset me. And I didn't like it. I was like, I'm never drinking again. That crap is for the birds. I didn't like it. And so I didn't until a couple years later. But especially, you know, with high school, you know, even after that, before I picked up another drink, I struggled very heavily with depression and self-harm. You know, I was suicidal for most of my teenage years and did make a pretty decent attempt one time and I ended up being institutionalized. I think it was Charter back in the day. I'm not sure which facility it was at, but I remember being in the emergency room and thinking, okay, because my thing was I was a stuffer. This stuff was very inconvenient. I didn't want people to know about this stuff, you know. So my thing was, okay, you know, I've harmed myself. I'm in the emergency room. We'll just pretend this didn't happen. Let's go back to, and they were like, of course, no, you're a 1013 now. You're going to a facility for a while. And I remember that just shook me to my core. And so they sent me off to a facility. And while I was there, I wasn't, you know, even my family, God bless my family, and you know, staff at this facility are trying to help me, and they're like, well, why are you so desperately self-destructing? What's going on with you? And I wouldn't tell them because, again, I didn't want to admit, you know, I'm a big old lesbian, and I just didn't want to go there. That's what I was struggling with, you know, and so I, at that point, I learned, you know, one of the things that would get me out of there, I just wanted to get out of there, is, you know, I would look at the wall and they had like these smiley face pictures or just these pictures of emotions, and they're like, well, how do you feel today? And I learned to not be honest. So this is when I started learning to be dishonest, because I would tell them, I'm like, I'm scared, I'm afraid, I'm hopeless. And then I was like, I'm feeling optimistic and hopeful. And I lied my way out of there and I got out. And it wasn't until, you know, a couple of years later, you know, I graduated high school, and so I was about 18, going on 19, and I met a friend from high school that kind of connected with me outside of high school, and they were like, and this friend kind of came to me, she said, hey, I'm out. And I said, what are you out of? What do you mean, what are you out of? What do you mean you're out? She's like, I'm gay, I'm dating a girl. And I was like, what? And I'm like, that's, why are you telling me? And everybody in the world knew that I was gay. And so, you know, for the first time, you know, out of high school, out of this little, you know, this little peer-centric bubble, and I realized there's a whole wide world out there and that people are gay and it's okay. And I came flying out and it was amazing. And my friend liked to party. And so I was like, you know what? Even though I hated alcohol that one time, I'm gonna try it again. The world is new. And so I did. We got drunk, you know, I drank that night with her. And that night, and I remember we were sitting on a porch in this apartment complex, and we were drinking, and I remember that feeling I got from that drink. And I remember, and I turned to her and I said, this is what I have missed my whole life. I want to feel this every day for the rest of my life. I finally felt a part of, I felt right, my skin fit. And I did, and I chased the hell out of that. And I drank daily. You know, we were underage, but we find ways. Where there's a will, there's a way. And drank daily. We even had a little biker guy that lived down the street. And he would, he'd come and bring us, you know, we would always tell him, it has to have a handle. Don't come back unless it has to have a handle. No pints, no little quarts. We want a handle of something. And he would, and God bless him. He was like, you little girls are going to kill yourself. And we're like, we're fine. And I remember, you know, and I did that for a long time. And man, and I still, it's almost, I kind of touch base about that a little later. But yeah, it's just, I remember that feeling. And that's, you know, when I think about sometimes, because it's been, like I said, you know, I've been sober, I think 13 years in September I'll be picking up. And every once in a while I get that, you know, this disease is rooted in my thinking. I get this little crazy thought, like, you were young. You know, you got sober when you were 23. You know, maybe you could drink casually. And I hear that voice and it just sounds insane in my head, but it's there. Well, I know that, but I always think back to that time when I was on that porch and that thought, and I said, no, alcohol. No, once a pickle, always a pickle. You know, that's not somebody who drinks casually. That's somebody that's gonna chase that bottle to death. You know, and I was, you know, and like I said, I started drinking and using drugs from 18 to, I came in here when I was 23 years old. And I mean, yeah, it wasn't a long time, but you know, I'd like to think I took the fast track to success. I paid for the extended course. You know, like I said, that one day we got drunk and I stayed drunk. And, you know, after a while, you know, started to have some consequences. And those consequences were uncomfortable. You know, I was having trouble with the job. I worked at Blockbuster now. I have a theme. I like media. And so I was at Blockbuster and I was having some issues with my job. And I was like, you know, and things at home were starting to happen. You know, my drinking was no longer cute and fun. And, oh, we're young. We're just living it up, partying. It was starting to get real. And on my 21st birthday, you know, we celebrated. We got drunk. And one of the things that... You know, one of the living amends that I make every day is that I, you know, one of the things about me when I'm drinking, one of the many, many, many things, is I was never a drunk that you could take the keys away from. I always had places to go and things to do and people to see. And, you know, that's just, you know, I'm a nurse now in the emergency room, you know, and I see a lot of, accidents and a lot of drunk driving accidents, and it just kind of haunts me, because I could, you know, I don't know how. I've had accidents, but by the grace of God, I never harmed anybody when I was out there. But that's something that bothers me. That's something that tremendously bothers me, you know. And on that day, we were out drinking, we got blitzed, and we got in the car. I don't know what happened. We totaled the car, you know, and I remember, you know, flipping down the guardrail. And then, because you just become a little lucid when that happens all of a sudden. I don't remember the night, but I remember spinning. And then we got out, and of course we're throwing away everything out of our pockets and everything out of the car, because we know the cops are going to come. And you know, and so that scared me. That scared me, because I could have killed you. I could have killed someone else. I had my best friend in the car. You know, and I was like, my God, you know, that was really real to me. I wanted to do something about that. And that night... You know, when I finally got home, I swore. I was like, I'm not drinking again. This is out of control, you know. And I meant it. Every cell of my body, down to my soul, everything, I'm done. I was drunk by 1 p.m. the next day. you know? And that happened time and time and time again from then on, you know? Many times waking up with those four horsemen, you know, humiliation and just shame and just remorse and regret and just self-loathing, you know? And every morning I'm not doing this again. And by night I'm drunk, you know? And I thought at one point, you know, I got the bright idea that, I don't know, better living through chemistry, I suppose. And I thought, well, maybe I just need some medication. Or maybe I just need, I don't know, switch something a little less volatile. So I did that, and that's when I started dabbling into getting into, you know, I stopped drinking. I wasn't drinking, but I was taking a fistful of pills every day. And I wasn't acquiring them through illegal means. I worked at a veterinary practice that I've since been able to make amends to. But, you know, I stole a lot of medications that way. And I got drugs, you know, all kinds of ways that I'm not proud of, you know. But I had to do what I had to do so that I could go a day, you know, in my own skin and just, you know, because I remember those days when I didn't have anything, when I didn't have access to anything. And I remember just sitting on the floor and just, you know, thinking, should I just throw myself in front of a car, you know, or, you know, what would be the most efficient way to take myself out? Because, you know, I just couldn't function without something, you know, could not function without something. And, you know, at one point, it, you know, and I had, like I said, you know, I had, you know, issues with depression and some other mental health things and, you know, lots of suicide attempts. I mean, I swear to God, I don't know. You know, many of us here were freaking miracles. We're not kidding when we say that we're miracles, because, my God, we're the most self-destructive people you can imagine, and here we are, you know? And various suicide attempts. But one night, I had just, you know, I'd been drinking and doing what I usually do, and it just occurred to me, you know, but this time it was different. Usually there was a lot of theatrics, there was a lot of, you know, I'm gonna jump off a bridge, you know, it was gonna be a whole to-do. This time it just clicked in my head. I was sitting on a porch and I said, and it was just like, you know, when you make a decision to go down to the drugstore, or, you know, I need to go get gas, or just go to the grocery store, I need to pick up a loaf of bread. It was like that. It was like, I'm gonna drive my truck off 575. Yeah, that's what needs to happen. I was just done. I was done. And the decision to do that was like, it just was the next natural step, you know. And something happened. You know, I got up, got my keys, and I remember, you know, it was a moment, it was like a flash. And something, it wasn't me, because it sure as shit wasn't me, because I was not saying things like this to myself. Said, it doesn't have to be this way. And for about 10 seconds, I had hope, and for 10 seconds, something gave me a new perspective. And that's all I needed. And I got on the phone, and I called my family. I said, I need help. And they brought me here, because I had come actually to Ridgeview like 6 months prior to this. Because I knew, I took like online quizzes, you know, I knew I had a drinking problem. And I came here, I actually had like a setup, like I think it was like a consultation or something, I don't know what it was, but I remember I went and I talked to somebody and I was honest, and they're like, dear God, you don't go home. And I'm like, no, I don't know. And they're like, please, no. I'm like, no, I don't think I'm ready for this. And so I'm not. And so, yeah, so that was funny. So I ended up back here, and I got to stay in the cottage cheese over there. And don't remember much of that. And I know that's when I've had my first 12-step meeting over there. And like I said, I don't remember much of those 12-step meetings over there, because it's the cottage cheese. And when I finally got out and was, you know, into the inpatient program out here, and I remember going to some of these meetings and just being around, you know, other addicts and alcoholics and just other people that are just fighting their demons too, you know. And I felt a kinship that I had never experienced before in my life. And especially when I remember when my first the first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I went to down here, that I remember that I was actually, you know, lucid enough and kind of with it enough, because I threw up all over this campus. Even though I was detoxed, I still, it just felt like just the stress, yeah, of not, just the stress of just going through a day with nothing in my system. I vomited all over this place. And so when I was finally kind of, you know, functioning, and I remember that first meeting, and I remember I was looking around, and all these people, you're like, you know, they're telling their stories and talking about, you know, how they used to drink and what's going on now. And I remember looking at them, and they were clean, you know, they looked content. They looked happy. They smelled good, you know, and I was like, I couldn't relate to them. I mean, I smelled like shit. I felt like shit. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, but I was listening. I could actually listen to what they were saying. And I was like, you are an alcoholic. You were a freaking drug addict. You were a crackhead. I couldn't tell, because look at you now. And that's the first time I got hope, you know, because I was a little crackhead too, you know. And that's one of the things, when crack kept me from drinking. So that's how I didn't drink for a while. So anywho, but yeah, but I that's when I really started to connect, and I felt that fellowship, and I felt that hope again that I felt for those 10 seconds that one night. And I was like, I have a chance. And I felt like a part of, and I felt like I belonged for the first time. Au naturel, if you will, you know, which is something, because I had never been able to experience that without glug glug or pill, you know, just, and that just, that kept me coming back. Of course, I was here for like 4 months or so, but because there was a little, I would like to say I was a model patient, but there were some shenanigans, and I had to stay a little longer. But I learned, it was a learning experience, and you know, God does for us what we need to do. I was right where I needed to be, so it was funny, because I don't know how it is now. Like I said, this was 2003, a while ago, but there was, you know, they had the girls on the top and the boys on the bottom, and everybody was on gender restriction, because all the girls were in, the guys, and then here comes me, and I was like, I know you people have had lesbians in here before. I know I'm not the first, but it was a thing. And so they didn't know what the hell to do with me for a little bit. But we worked through that. But that just always cracked me up. So when I got out of Ridgeview, you know, I got, you know, started going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to NA as well, and Cocaine Anonymous, and just, I really felt my niche in AA. For me, that's where I felt my, you know, my niche, and so I really focused on Alcoholics Anonymous, got a sponsor, and, you know, I got one of those sponsors that, you know, she was like, this is life and death, you know, this is what we do. If you don't want to do it, you go work with somebody else, you're going to go drink. You know, this is what, you know, you do this or you drink. And I was like, geez, Cheryl, God, it's extreme, you know, but, you know, just like, you know, but, you know, being 23 years old, weighing 90 pounds and liver failure because you can't, you know, because you haven't eaten in almost a year, is, that's not extreme. You know, it's like, even though I went through that hell, just how quickly, forgot. You know, I went through that hell, you know, and then I got a little sobriety. Ridgeview patched me up, padded me up, put my little band-aids on, and I was feeling good. And I was like, that seems extreme to me. I wasn't sure about all that. And I was like, well, I'll muddle through it. You know, I had my little friends. Again, you know, I was 23. I had my little friends in AA, and so, you know, it's social. We do our things, and oh, yeah, sure. I told my sponsor I did my second step, you know, and, you know, kind of did all that. And I mean, it is what it is. You know, I was right where I needed to be. But eventually, you know, my sponsor was like, you know, called me out on my stuff and was like, you know, you're not doing what you need to do. You're not going to meetings. You're not doing the things you need to do. She said, you're going to drink. And I was like, and, you know, and I remember one thing she always told me was, you know, there will come a time where the only thing between you and a drink is God. And I just was like, yeah, Cheryl, yeah, okay. You know, just things, I mean, you know, just, and it's so funny, I have sponsees, I can feel them on the phone. Yeah, Leah, sure. You know, I can tell them, like, it's a phone, are you holding the phone away? Hey, you know, I know, because I am you. And so, you know, and eventually, you know, I said, you know what, Cheryl, this isn't really working out. And she's like, you're right. So, you know, we had a mutual firing, and then I didn't get another sponsor. And I did, and I was dry for about 3 years. I would just kind of like show up every once in a while, maybe every few months, just to, and of course on my year to pick up my chip and tell y'all how I did it from home. Oh yeah. So, and it was, and I was pretty miserable. I was absolutely miserable. Like, I wasn't at risk of getting DUIs. Yeah, I wasn't smoking crack, but I was not. It was a matter of time, and I was miserable. I was insane. My thinking was skewed. I was jealous. I was pissy, and I was still suicidal, you know? And eventually, I did drink, because why not? I didn't care. I knew, you know, it's one of the things it says self-knowledge. You know, self-knowledge will not keep us sober, and it sure as shit won't, you know? Because I knew damn well I could not drink successfully. I knew I could not use drugs casually. You know, I knew that. I didn't care. That was the thing. Apathy is what got me. I didn't care. You know, I was miserable. Might as well be miserable and drunk. And I got drunk, and it was awful because 3 years of abstinence really kills your tolerance. And when you only know how to drink alcoholically, you don't, you know, you're not sipping, and, you know, I'm not ordering cocktails. So it was rough. But by the grace of God, God bless my mother. She came and picked me up, and I puked all the way back to her house. And the next day, I was at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Anyway, I live out over in Ackworth, so I was going to Hal Place. It was a place, a clubhouse out there I was familiar with, and I went back to Hal Place. And I remember I went in, and, you know, and I thought I was, you know, prior to this, I was big time. I had 3 years of sobriety. And so, you know, coming back in there, and then going to the beginners meeting, and one of the guys, he's since passed, he said, you know, let's go around the table and let everybody say how much time you got. And of course, I'm sitting right next to Robert, and I'm snotting and sniffling. One day, you know, just a sobbing snot mess, you know. I was just broken because I realized that not only was drugs, you know, not only was I completely powerless over drugs and alcohol, but I was completely powerless over myself. I was a shit show. I was a walking shit show. I did not know how to do sobriety. I did not know how to live life effectively on my own, you know? Whether I have a drink or a drug in my body, I am still wired inappropriately, you know? The universe didn't make us to self-destruct. You know, there's something fundamentally, there's something wrong, you know? And I remember prior to that, everybody kept telling me, you know, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like, we have a sufficient substitute. We have a sufficient substitute, Leah. We have something. You know, because there was that hole, that emptiness that I never could get rid of. And, you know, and so when I came back in, I was ready to find that sufficient substitute. And one woman in the meeting came up to me afterwards and gave me a hug and said, honey, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. And she offered to be my sponsor. And her name was Donna. And she was an amazing woman. She was my sponsor for 8 years. She passed in 2015. But she changed my life. And I think about her every day of my life. You know, she took me and she was like my second mother. You know, she showed, you know, and one of the things that she got me very heavily involved with was service, you know, because one of the things she instilled is because I kept thinking, I was like, because I kept trying to think my way into better living. You know, this is the problem. You can't use this. I can't use this to fix my problem. My problem is centered in my brain. And she said, you know, you have to change your behavior and the thinking will follow. And so she taught me how to start behaving differently. She simplified it for me because everything was so freaking complex. Like, how am I supposed to do all this? I'm not this kind of person. And she was just act like it. Just do it. Okay. And I did, you know, because at that point I realized I didn't know better than everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know better than everybody at Ridgeview. I didn't know everybody in every 12-step program ever created on earth. I did not know better than them. They knew something, and it was working for millions of people across the world, you know? And so it was very humbling, and I started doing the things, and she got me involved in service work in the group. You know, I was a little group secretary. I was, you know, we stayed, it was a big clubhouse, so we stayed, we swept, we cleaned, we picked up cigarette butts, you know, whatever I needed to do, you know. I participated in meetings. I was held accountable, you know. And we started working the steps. And like I said, I wasn't, you know, religion was not something that I grew up with, or spirituality, if you will, was not something, it was very alien to me. I didn't know. You know, I grew up, you know, my dad was from, he unfortunately was just traumatized from this fire and brimstone experience he had as a kid, that he was just religion. So that's what I thought. And so they had to work and tell me that we're not asking you to find religion, Leah, you know. Spirituality, God of your understanding. Whatever the hell it is to you, whatever you want it to be, just find it. It's in the seeking. God is in the seeking, you know? And I just started to open my mind to that. And I remember, you know, going through the steps. And to be honest, you know, step one, easy peasy. I knew that. I was a disaster. You know, the other two, I just put faith in y'all. I put faith in the program. I put faith in the people that had gone before me and had sobriety and had higher powers in their lives. And I put my faith in you because I didn't know any of this. You know, one of the things in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when it talks about, Bill talks about being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. I used to always roll my eyes at that part. I thought that was a bit theatrical. But he wasn't freaking kidding. You know, when you get there, you know it. You felt like you've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. It's not fluff. You know, and I remember, you know, I was working these steps, you know, I was doing them, you know, as she asked, you know, I was being honest, you know, doing the work. And I didn't really feel it, you know. I never got like a white light, you know. But it was so funny. It was after a meeting, and it was kind of an older member, someone who had, she had a ton of time, and she would not call on me. I had my hand raised the whole time. And she, frickin' Nancy, I want to talk. And she would not call on me. I was pissed. And I remember driving home from that meeting. Why my higher power intervened at this point, I don't know. But as crazy as it sounds, I drove a little pickup truck. And I remember driving, I was just... And I felt... I don't care if y'all think I'm crazy. I felt a presence in the car with me. There was a presence there. And it instantly... All I felt was calm, peace. And I felt God. I felt God in my little pickup truck last night coming, you know, or that night coming home from that meeting that I was all bent out of shape because I didn't get to share. And from then on, that spiritual journey just took off, you know, and it's constantly evolving. You know, where I'm at right now with my spiritual life is changing even more. I mean, you know, that's what it says. God is in the seeking. You know, I don't have to once, you know, I don't have to have like this list of what this is, what my spirituality consists of. But what I do is the spiritual principles behind each of these steps, I try to practice on an absolute daily basis. You know, that's the only must for me. But everything else as far as what I'm spiritually experiencing or investigating or exploring or learning, I mean, that's wide open, you know? But as long as I'm growing, you know, I'm given a daily reprieve contingent upon my spiritual maintenance. And I was told by an old timer that maintenance doesn't mean that you just stay like this. Maintenance of a spiritual program means you're maintaining growth. And so that was key. I had to learn that because, yeah, I thought I could just coast. I like to coast. And I have to get kicked off my laurels a lot because I like to coast. It's nice. So, but, you know, growing doesn't allow me to do that so much. You know, and this program has taken me places that, you know, I went from being just this horrifically scared, just self-loathing, traumatized person to where I was just afraid of the world. You know, if I could, I would have holed up in my parents' basement for the end of time. I mean, that was kind of my plan. I figured I'd just die down there. They'd find me one day. And that was their fear. And that's something that I make a living amends to them, that they never have to do that again. They never have to worry. Is today the day we're going to go down there and she's gone? You know? And, you know, and I always think back too of back when I used to pray, to God to change me, to make me normal, and how angry I was at him that he never helped me. He never helped me with that. And it was, you know, a couple years into sobriety, I had that profound feeling from my higher power that, you know, you see why I didn't answer those prayers, you know. And never once, you know, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous have I felt different or not a part of. You know, I'm just Leah. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And that's all that matters to me. And that's all you people ever made me feel like. And that's just the greatest feeling in the world, you know. And that's one of my favorite things. I have, you know, some friends outside the program or just, you know, work people I work with. And we'll go out and we'll see all these people. And I'll be like, hey. And I'm like, why the hell you know all these people? And I'm like, friends of the family, you know, because anonymity, I can't tell them, you know, we're all drunks. So I'm like, God dang, you know a lot of people. And I'm like, So, you know, but it's just, you know, you get to know everybody. You get to know everybody, all walks of life. It doesn't matter. We're all, you know, we're all recovering from that. We're all liners of that great passenger ship that's, I can't remember the, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, you know, connected in that common bond, you know, surviving this disease. And, you know, one of the things, do we end at 8:45? What time do I need to stop? Oh, I'm not going to go over, but no. I start twitching when people go over. I don't want to do that to anybody. Is it 8:45? Like, wound up? Okay. Say 8:20. I do. I'll be so into a speaker story, but as soon as it goes 5 minutes over, I'm like, all right. So, but, and one of the things, you know, when I got sober, you know, like I said, I was working at Blockbuster and doing all those things. And because one of the things I felt like I didn't deserve, I've always loved medicine. I've always loved working in medicine. I was a veterinary technician for years and all that other stuff. But I felt like I could never go back to that because I had abused that, you know. I had violated the trust of my employer. I had, you know, participated in illegal activities as far as, you know, stealing narcotic medications. And I just felt like I could never do that again. You know, and it took years, you know, years working the program, working the steps and working with my sponsor and just, you know, that, you know, she said, you know, I think it's time. I think go back to, you know, do you still have a love for that? And I said, absolutely. I said, I hate retail. I want to do retail. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but you know you don't like it, you know? So, and I was like, if you do, God bless you, you know? But I was like, I love medicine. I want to go back to it, you know? And she said, you know, do it. And I did, and I went back, and I got to work with animals again and do my veterinary technician, and then, you know, got to another point where it was like, you know, I also like to pay my, I got a mortgage now, and I like to be able to pay that, and, you know, we only do so much with that. So I went back to school and got my nursing license. And, you know, prior to that, I was in college, but flunked out, dropped out, it, whichever, potato, potato. You know, Kennesaw sent me a letter. They're like, please don't come back. So I had, that was my only college experience, was just incredible failure. And so I was very nervous about going back to school. It had been like 10 years. And I went back and I was able to get my nursing license. And right now, you know, I've been, I'm an emergency room nurse at a hospital. I've been able to do it for 2 years. And I love it. You know, I love it. You know, it's something I never thought I could do. Because this is not a job for somebody who's frightened and timid and scared. You know, you have to be brave, you have to be bold. And, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to walk through fear. You know, like when I came in here and saw all you people, I wanted to throw up, you know? But I didn't, you know, I just said, we got this, God, let's do it, you know? And I have this amazing career where I get to help people. You know, I get to help people. And I've become, you know, the kind of employee that can be trusted, that's dependable. And I just got a promotion a month ago. They put me, I'm the new weekday, the new week charge nurse. So, you know, I'm just like, whoa, you know, it's just, it's insane. I've become somebody that I never dreamed I could be. You know, I was not reliable. I was not somebody that could be counted on. I was not professional. You know, I wasn't a good person, if you will. I lied, I thieved, I would steal from you in a heartbeat, you know. And one of the amends I make as far as, you know, to my employers is I don't go home, you know, so much with as a pin. Because that's just something to me. The doctor I worked for, you know, when I was using, I wasn't able to make full amends to him because he did pass away when I got sober. But so it's my living amends to him, is that, you know, I will not, you know, do anything to jeopardize, you know, just because that was my thing too. I didn't think like companies, because especially doing the fourth and fifth step, I learned like companies and businesses, I didn't think it mattered if you hurt them or stole from them because they're companies and businesses. It doesn't matter. It's all corporate nonsense. Who cares? It's not going to hurt anybody. It does. And it's not about that. That's about me being deceitful and being dishonest and stealing, you know. And Donna, you know, she showed me, she was like, you know, what do you think happens what do you think happens, that store that you stole all that from, what do you think happens to the manager of that store? Do you think they're just going to be like, oh, somebody stole $300 worth of merchandise from you, it's all good? Or that cashier you shortchanged, or this and this. Who do you think? It affects somebody. It hurts somebody. And regardless of that, it is not how you live a spiritual life. So that was something. So that's what I mean, like every aspect, you know, because I used to pick and choose where I wanted to be spiritual, you know. It's everywhere. Every aspect of my life, I got to practice these spiritual principles. You know, I'm happily married today. You know, my wife would be here, but she's sick. We've had a week-long snot festival going on at our house. It is unpleasant. It's unrelenting. So you can burn this. You probably might want to burn it. But, you know, it's just something I never thought that would ever happen. Not in my lifetime, not here, you know. But I'm just forever grateful the life I have. She's in recovery as well, you know. I have a pot-bellied pig. I have a ton of dogs and cats. It's obscene. But the life I have now, I could have never dreamed up. If you first sat me down when I first got sober and asked what kind of life do you envision in sobriety, I wouldn't have touched this. I wouldn't have known this was possible. A charge nurse in an emergency room, happily married. What the hell? No. That all sounds horrifying. The responsibility, you know, the accountability. I'm not possible. I'm not capable of that. You know, the friendships, the relationships I have, you know, when I was drinking and using, me and my sister were completely estranged, you know, we had a falling out and I didn't speak to her for years. And it wasn't until I got sober and she had her side. I didn't go to her wedding. I missed the birth of my nephew. I had written her off, didn't care. And it wasn't until I started doing the step work that I realized for the first time in my life, I played a part in that dissolution of that relationship. I was not a victim. I was kind of an asshole. And it was awakening. I'll never forget that moment. It's just like I was sitting on this little pedestal and God just boop and crashing down to earth. And it took me physically to my knees. And I reached out to her and we reconnected and just bawled and just, you know, talked and just caught up, and I held my nephew, and now she's such a big part of my life. You know, now I got two nephews and a niece, you know, but just things like that, learning. I mean, I could imagine if I had continued going the way I was, how much I would have missed out if I would have, you know, lived long enough to miss out on all that. But still, you know, I wouldn't have a sister. I wouldn't have these incredible relationships in my life. I wouldn't have an opportunity to help people daily, you know. And I'm just forever grateful for that. You know, I have, you know, my sponsor passed in 2015. And, you know, it was just over the weekend and, you know, I was devastated and heartbroken, of course. But I knew, I was like, I gotta get a new sponsor, because I remember from earlier when I dropped that, I was like, I gotta get a sponsor, because I was terrified. I didn't want to go through that again where I was like, I just wouldn't get another sponsor. And Diane was, she came to my home group all the time, and she's just one of those little she walks about that much off the ground. She's just this spiritual behemoth. And I asked her to be my sponsor and she took me on, and it's just been amazing. I have an amazing sponsorship family. I mean, just, and all it is I just have to shut up, get out of the way. And I mean, this is all laid out. It's simple. It's not easy, but it's very simple. You know, and that was the biggest thing. You know, and I'll never forget, early in sobriety, somebody said, self-esteem comes from esteemable acts. I have never forgotten that. Because, you know, that's, you know, I never, I thought I had self-esteem before, but you think you have self-esteem until you get true self-esteem, and then you're like, wow, that's self-esteem. I can look at myself in the mirror. I like who I see. I lay down at night. I rest my head. I don't have that, you know, I'm at peace, you know. feel good about who I am today, you know, and it's all because, you know, it's not about me, you know, it's kind of that paradox, you know, I have all these freaking sayings, and then I get up on a podium, and I'm like, selflessness through selflessness is one found. Yeah, I love that part of the extended serenity prayer. Only through selflessness is one found. Kind of running out of things to say, and I don't want to just babble on about nonsense. But yeah, I'm getting a thumbs up. But thank you guys for having me and listening to me talk for a while. And I'm just very grateful to be here. Like I said, my journey started at Ridgeview. Is the food still good? Are some of y'all still here? It's good. I like the food. Okay, good. I like the food. I remember the food. It was good. I gained like 20 pounds, but that's what happens when you stop doing crack. So, but well, all right. Well, thank you guys so much for having me.
Funny story. Leah probably doesn't even know this story, but her wife, I knew her wife before she even met Leah, and her wife came up to me before they were married. Her name's Gabby. She came up to me and she said, "There is the new girl. She is so gorgeous." I'm like, "Well, go talk to her." So it's all because of me. Isn't it always, right? I'm kidding, of course, but thank you so much, Leah. You're beautiful. Thank you.